We will hear arguments first this morning in the Regents of the University of Michigan against Ewing. Mr. Dane, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case is here on certiorari to the Sixth Circuit, which concluded that the University of Michigan had treated the respondent unconstitutionally when it denied him two chances to take a test that he'd flunked in the university's medical school. For purposes of this argument, I shall assume the existence of a constitutionally protectable property right in respondent's continued enrollment in the university's medical school while on what might be termed good academic behavior. And I shall argue that the Sixth Circuit erred in its decision that the university arbitrarily and capriciously deprived Mr.
May I ask why you make that assumption?
Because, Justice Powell,
you don't concede it, do you?
I just assume it, as the Court did in Horowitz, because I believe it is not essential to reach that issue in order to decide this case on the narrower ground of whether Mr. Ewing was treated by the university in an arbitrary and capricious way.
So you simply make an assumption.
I'm assuming for the purposes of the argument the existence of the protectable property interest.
What if we disagree with you on your argument, though?
What happens to the property interest issue? We just affirm then or not?
Oh, certainly not, Justice White. I think you would be able to find that Mr. Ewing was not treated in an arbitrary and capricious way and was not deprived of the property interest.
What if we agree with the Court of Appeals that if there is a property interest, there was a constitutional violation?
Then, of course, I suppose you would have to affirm if
because you have not going to argue about the property interest issue, is that it?
I must say, Justice White, that the idea of arguing the property interest has some appeal for me, and the idea that there should not be a property interest in such a thing as a course grade or a qualification, an academic qualification.
You didn't present the property interest question in your petition.
That's correct.
I'm not sure I agree with Justice White on that. Your second question presented, as I read it, is a state medical school's procedurally correct dismissal of an academically deficient student subject to substantive due process review and reversal by the federal courts. I think that raises the property interest.
Clearly, it is within the parameters of the question as framed in the petition, Justice Rehnquist. I agree.
The Solicitor General said he thought the question was in the case.
Yes, and the Solicitor General's position, Justice Powell, is, as I said, quite attractive to me. I just think that the case can be disposed of on a narrower basis. I'll argue the property interest if the Court wishes. I don't mean to suggest that it is not a legitimate question. I mean to suggest only that I believe the case can be disposed of on the narrower grounds of whether...
Well, maybe we think it's narrower to decide it on whether it's property.
Very well. Justice O'Connor, we...
What is the agreement or the understanding that students have who are admitted to the medical school in your state?
The understanding that they have, Justice O'Connor, is that they should be permitted to proceed in the program while they are meeting the requirements of the medical school's faculty, while they are on what I termed a minute ago good academic behavior.
Are there provisions in the application forms that make it a matter of discretion of the faculty to retain the student?
In the official bulletins of the medical school, Justice O'Connor, and I'm referring now to Exhibits 36 and 39, which are the two bulletins which were effective at the time Mr. Ewing matriculated and at the time he flunked out. There are clear provisions conferring upon the promotion boards discretion to pass, to fail, or to take any one of many intermediate actions between those two extremes with respect to the enrolled students. Yes. I'd like to review quite briefly Mr. Ewing's record at Michigan. He matriculated in the fall of 1975. He flunked out in the summer of 81. While he was with us, he accumulated an unenviable academic record, which included numerous low grades, 7 incompletes, 2 terms during which he was on leaves of absence, several terms during which he was on an irregular or reduced course load schedule, and the faculty had devoted considerable time to helping him along at the point which was reached in midsummer 1980 when they warned him in writing, and that writing appears at 146 of the joint appendix, that one more deficiency would be cause for his being dropped from registration. Now, that deficiency could have taken the form, if the court please, of a failure in a course grade, a failure on a final exam, but in Mr. Ewing's case, it took the form of a failure on the National Board of Medical Examiners Part 1 exam. This is a 2-day exam which tests students in 7 subject matter areas. Mr. Ewing flunked 5 out of the 7 with the egregiously low score of 235 against a passing standard of 345, which has since been raised to 380. That score was the lowest in the Interflex program, the combined baccalaureate and medical school program in which the respondent was enrolled. And occasioned concern on the part of the Faculty Promotion and Review Board, which met the following month to review his record and determine his eligibility to continue. That meeting took place on July 24, 81, and was the first of what was to be 5 meetings of the Michigan faculty devoted to reviewing Mr. Ewing's record. There were 2 promotion board meetings and 3 meetings of the medical school's executive committee. If you add all that up, you'll find that over 24 senior faculty members at the University of Michigan's medical school devoted countless hours to reviewing Mr. Ewing's progress through the medical school, both before and after.
Where is Mr. Ewing now?
He is in Chicago. I'm informed by counsel enrolled in the Chicago College of Osteopathy, Justice Blackmun.
I take it there's no racial overtone in this case.
None whatsoever. The faculty reviews were unanimous of the opinion that Mr. Ewing should be dropped from registration. He appealed the first such determination. He appeared before the Faculty Promotion and Review Board, submitted both written evidence and spoke to the board, and was questioned by the board. Significantly, the questions, particularly those posed by Dr. Friedman, were directed to the point that Mr. Ewing was well aware at the time he sat for the examination of the gravity of his academic condition at that point. Dr. Friedman also testified, by the way, that he alone...
May I ask you just one question at this point?
Certainly.
What is all this relevant to? If he has no constitutional right, the university didn't have to do any of this, did it? What is the legal point that you're making? I'm kind of curious.
The legal point, Justice Steve, is the care and deliberation which went into the decision to terminate...
But they didn't have to do any of that, did they?
No, they didn't as a matter of law. I think they overdid what they were required to do.
But how does that go to the question of what they were required to do, which is really what we're interested in?
It goes to the admonition of this court in Board of Curators v. Horowitz, I believe, Your Honor, that a careful and deliberate decision made by professional decision makers such as those on Michigan's faculty, should not be reviewed by the courts.
Mr. Duran.
Yes, Justice.
This suit is against the state of Michigan, isn't it?
Yes, Justice.
Did you consider the 11th Amendment issue?
Yes, we have argued them on brief.
Are you going to argue that?
I hadn't intended to today,
you,
Your
you
Honor.
Rest
I would,
you rest on your brief.
I would rest on the briefs, yes.
Do you think we have jurisdiction?
Yes. The 11th Amendment issue in this case is interesting because of the way in which the case stands at the intersection of the 11th and the 14th. There really are very few federal rights implicated by the complaint Mr. Ewing makes against the University of Michigan. He asserts, in essence, that what we've done is failed to follow what is really a state law rule. He doesn't assert that we have deprived him of a specific federal right protected by the Bill of Rights. He doesn't say, for example, that his dismissal was pretextual in any way. He doesn't allege racial or any other sort of invidiousness, nor could he. He doesn't allege that he has been punished for the exercise of a First Amendment freedom of speech privilege, anything of that kind. What he argues is that our decision makers were prevented, or should have been prevented, from making the professional academic decision that they made by a so-called rule which automatically entitled him to take two cracks at passing the NBME exam. If you strip the bark off his argument, that's really what it amounts to. He's complaining about the decision of the faculty which considered him to be an unqualified student, unqualified to go forward.
On the 11th Amendment issue, there is a motion, as I understand it, by the respondent to be allowed to amend the complaint now to name the regents individually.
That's correct.
To try to meet that issue. Do you oppose the granting of that motion?
We did not file a response to that motion, Justice O'Connor, and my candid opinion is that it really doesn't change the applicability of the 11th Amendment defense. Because the motion.
You think if they were named individually that you could still argue the 11th Amendment defense?
Yes, I do, Justice O'Connor, because the motion does not seek to name them in their individual capacities. It seeks to name them in their official capacities. And it seems to me that really does not change the nature of the case for 11th Amendment purposes in any terribly significant way.
I understand you to say you believe that you can amend a complaint in this court. You're willing to let that happen?
Respondent appears to be of that opinion.
Well, do you agree with it or not?
Well, I think it's very late in the day, Justice Marshall.
Do you agree
but we
with
did,
it or not?
We did not oppose it, and therefore.
Do you agree with it?
Yes.
You agree with it?
Yes.
Well, will you give me one precedent?
Hutto, I don't mean to be arguing respondent's case, but he cited.
Well, you're as responsible for jurisdiction as he is.
Yes, Your Honor. Hutto v. Finney, I believe, is the case upon which respondent relies. Sorry, I think it's Brandon v. Holt. I misspoke. Brandon v. Holt, 469 U.S. Justice Marshall is the case upon which respondent's argument is premised.
That's it?
That's it.
Was there any similar motion made before the District Court or the Court of Appeals?
There was not, Your Honor.
And so neither of those courts had had an opportunity to consider this question?
That's correct, Your Honor. There was an 11th Amendment decision made by the District Court which concerned the respondent's claims for damages in that court and dismissed count 3 of the complaint on the basis of the 11th Amendment. That decision, of course, preceded this Court's decision in Pennhurst. And in Pennhurst, when the Court decided that it was an intolerable intrusion upon state sovereignty for federal courts to order states to conform their conduct to state law, it changed the nature of the 11th Amendment issue for us, sort of midway between the district court and the Court of Appeals. We argued the Pennhurst case on application for rehearing in the Court of Appeals, and that application for rehearing was denied.
May I just ask this question about the 11th Amendment? In your principal brief, you start out arguing the 11th Amendment, and then when you reach the merits, you said that the decision on the merits, it sounded a shockwave throughout the community of medical schools throughout the country, apparently suggesting to me at least that you thought it of great national importance that the merits be addressed. Then you didn't really argue 11th Amendment again. And I was wondering if perhaps you decided to waive it so we could reach the merits.
No,
you're not waiving it.
I do not waive it, Justice Stevens.
Just let the shockwave have its effect.
But I... Well, I do think the 14th Amendment issue is of critical importance to the higher education community and to the tradition of academic freedom in this country, which this Court's precedents and policy have upheld for many, many years. And that is the issue that I intended to address with the Court this morning. I'd like to get back to the contention on the part of respondent that the university failed to follow its own rule in this case when it denied him a second chance at the exam. I'd like to assure the court that this is not a case in which the University of Michigan failed to follow its own rule. In the first place, we had no rule automatically entitling a student to a retest. Each retest, which was granted after specific action of the Promotion and Review Board authorizing such a retest. That action was an exercise of the discretion, which I earlier made reference to in the university's bulletins.
Mr. Dane, in the opinion of the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and I'm looking now at page 33A, where that opinion is contained in the petition. The Court of Appeals says, in sum, the evidence demonstrates that it was the consistent practice of the University of Michigan to allow a qualified medical student who initially failed the MBME Part 1 an opportunity for a retest. Do you challenge that factual determination of the Court of Appeals?
I challenge the way in which the Court of Appeals expressed it, Justice Rehnquist. I would rather call it a consistent result than a consistent practice. But it is true that Mr. Ewing was the only one of the several students with whom he compares himself who was not afforded the opportunity for a retest. But that result came about as a product of the specific individual review by the Promotion Board in each case of the eligibility of each student to continue.
Your position, then, is it was the consistent practice, or at least the consistent result, but the circumstances were sufficiently different in Ewing's case so that a different result was justified?
They were considered sufficiently difficult by the faculty, Justice Rehnquist, yes.
I'm not sure I understand the university's policy. Suppose the medical student is taking 15 courses and he fails all 15. Is he given a rerun on every one of them?
I can't answer that question because I'm not a medical educator, Mr. Chief Justice.
Well, that's an element in this case, isn't it, in the light of the statement of the policy of allowing reexamination?
Reexaminations are allowed in the discretion of the faculty when the faculty considers it appropriate to do so on the basis of the student's potential, the student's overall record, performance in the courses already taken. There's an awful lot of subjective judgment that goes into those decisions, Mr. Chief Justice, and therefore it is very difficult for me to answer.
Is there anything in this record about whether they're allowed a third crack at the examination if they fail?
Certainly, sometimes they are. But again,
medical school.
It is not the product of an automatic right. That's the point I wish to emphasize. The other point about that which I wish to emphasize is that when Mr. Ewing took the examination for the first time, he had been warned, and he understood the warning that he had received, that one more deficiency would be cause for his termination. So I suggest to the Court that if there's to be a rule in this case, that's what it is. One more deficiency, and you're out.
When you refer to that warning, are you referring to the warning on page 146 that you called our attention to before?
Yes, Justice.
Because it really doesn't quite say that. It says it would be grounds for dismissal. It doesn't say you would be dismissed.
It reminds him of the earlier warning. Which appears at 144, in which it says the board also specified that any further academic deficiencies will lead to your being dropped from registration in the Interflex program. I haven't said anything about Youngberg v. Romeo, and my time is approaching its end. Youngberg is an important precedent for this case. In Youngberg, this Court held that a professional decision made by professional decision-makers should not be overturned by courts. If the decision is rational, it is beyond the reach of the judiciary, is how I read Youngberg. Unless the decision is so irrational as to make it evident that it was actually not based upon professional judgment, it must be left untouched. Now, we're not seeking a radical remedy in this Court. All we're seeking is a continuation of that precedent and the wise policy which has informed this Court over time concerning academic freedom. We contend that an academic qualification decision should not be subject to substantive due process review. We don't want to bar the courtroom doors to students who wish to assert that they have been treated invidiously, that any of their federally protected rights have been denied them. But what we do want to do is keep the courts out of the business of making academic grade and qualification judgments. And I submit that that follows the precedent of Horowitz and Youngberg and is wise national policy. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may, Mr. Chief Justice.
Very well. Mr. Conway.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether the regents must abide by their own procedures and rules, which they had publicly promulgated to students to rely upon. The regents were free in the first instance in their sole discretion to establish whatever standards, rules, and procedures they wanted to measure academic performance, including Ewing's performance. But having set the rules to govern this important relationship between institution and student, the regents must abide by their same rules if those rules are set on an objective standard. If to do otherwise would, as it did in this case, result in the deprivation of a respondent's property interest.
Do those rules kind of amount to a contract, in your view?
Yes, they do. Under Michigan law, Justice Rehnquist, the Booker case cited by the Sixth Circuit, it's a matter of state law that a student is not to be arbitrarily dismissed, in that case, from a medical school. In this instance, the crucial thing that makes this case so unique is that the violation of the rule resulted in the deprivation of the property interest, that is, his dismissal.
And then what, do the federal courts simply apply Michigan contract law?
Under Sinderman and all the cases, Your Honor, the issue is whether there's a property interest, we look to state law. In this case, looking to state law, which is Michigan in this instance, there is a property interest not to be arbitrarily dismissed. Now,
and it's based on an agreement between the regents and the
We've cited many cases in our brief, Your Honor, which suggests under various states that the relationship between a student and a university is contractual.
And is there a federal parole evidence rule and a federal statute of frauds to govern these kind of contractual claims?
Well, Your Honor, as you know, under Sinderman, it doesn't even have to rise to the level of an actual contract. Under the Iago case, if there's a reasonable expectation of a right, it can be a property interest under federal law or for federal law purposes, even though doesn't rise to the official level of a contract.
But here I thought you said the federal court just to apply Michigan law.
The Michigan law being, Your Honor, whether there's a property interest. Once there's a property interest, then the federal interest here is whether, in violation of the Due Process Clause, the state or its agents in their official capacity have deprived Ewing of his property interest, which was initially created by state law.
That's slicing it awfully thin, isn't it, the distinction between federal law and
state? Your Honor, I think it's well grounded in the precedence of this Court that there isn't any federal notion of a property interest, that the federal notion of a property interest must look to state law. That's what the Sinderman case stands for. That's what the Sixth Circuit applied. And it's very clear on these facts, which distinguish it from some of the other cases where the arbitrary and capricious test was addressed by the lower courts, that there is, in fact, as a matter of state law, a property interest.
Now, the Sixth Michigan Circuit courts addressed the nature of the interest at the medical school, at the university, under the kind of admission policies that are written in the application?
Your Honor,
Mr. Conway,
I think the courts addressed it in this sense. We have on this fact record the existence of a rule promulgated by Michigan. They were free not to do so.
What rule are you talking about?
I'm talking about Plaintiff's Exhibit 3, which is in the Joint Appendix at 113 and 114. It was published by the Regents, and actually it was disseminated to students, faculty, and the world approximately a week before Ewing took the examination. And it quotes Associate Dean Gibson. And it's very clear in answer to Mr. Chief Justice's question about what's the rule in other situations. It applies only to this examination. And it says that, according to Dean Gibson, any student, and I'm paraphrasing, well, let me quote it. According to Dr. Gibson, everything possible is done to keep qualified medical students in the medical school. This even extends to taking and passing national board exams. Should a student fail either part of the national boards, an opportunity is provided to make up the failure in a second exam. That's in the Joint Appendix at 113. They, in this instance...
May I ask whether you're reading the word qualified out of your interpretation?
We don't have to define. I'm reading the word qualified as the administrators themselves read it. At trial, Mr. Davis, counsel for Michigan, was asked by the district judge, let's lay this question to rest. Was Mr. Ewing qualified when he went in to take the NBME exam? And Mr. Davis responded to the affirmative. Similarly, Dean Reed, who was the director of the Interflex program, testified that he was qualified. And Dr. Gibson, who's quoted in Plaintiff's Exhibit 3, was asked at trial, what does qualified mean? Qualified means he had passed all of his courses. And it was
Conway,
undisputed that Ewing has.
Mr. Conway, what is this Plaintiff's Exhibit 3? This a formally adopted rule of the university?
Well, it's not promulgated in the sense that a federal regulation is promulgated, Justice O'Connor.
Well, what is it?
It is this publication, which I have before you. It's called On Becoming a Doctor. It says Medical Center Report, Special Issue, the University of Michigan. And at the conclusion, which we set out this in the Joint Appendix, it indicates that it's part of the medical center. It's published under the auspices of the University of Michigan.
Well, it simply is a publication. It didn't form part of the admissions application?
No, this publication came out, Justice O'Connor, about a week before Mr. Ewing took this examination.
Did it come out before he applied for admission as a student at the university?
No, it's some
was
6 years.
Part of the agreement he made with the university?
Yes, Your Honor, it's part of the agreement.
How so, if it hadn't been published when he was admitted as
because,
a student?
Because, Your Honor, Mr. Ewing would have had the option not to take this exam if he knew it was one strike and you're out. If you know the rules in advance, anybody can play the game. Anybody can succeed. That's the notion of fair play we have here. They told Mr. Ewing that you get two tries. It's as if, Your Honor, let me pose two hypotheticals. If the university said you need 120 credit hours to graduate,
And a student went through 3 years at the university, and then the university went to a given senior and said to this woman, you have to have 150 hours to graduate, just you. Or if we were in a classroom and the professor said, you have 3 hours to complete this examination, and after 1 hour, he randomly went and took one student's exam away from him and didn't let him complete it, would the courts be powerless to do anything? I think not. The courts have thought not. For 50 years, courts, and we've cited in our brief, have held that arbitrary and capricious conduct can be remedied.
Those examples are hardly comparable to this situation.
Justice Blackmun, I suggest they are in this instance. Mr. Ewing knew he had two chances. If he had only had one chance, then he would be prepared to live or die on his result. He knew he had two chances. It's like a battle.
Would you select him as your physician?
I would, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, let me please address that, because I think it's an important point, and I know there's some levity in response to that point. This young man is now in medical school. He is going to be a physician.
He's in an osteopathic school.
And as Your Honor knows, there is an osteopathic physician. It has all the rights of an MD graduate, can perform surgery in all the states, can perform in the same manner. His school is accredited. There's AMA approval of osteopathic schools. The significance of this, Your Honor, is that despite what the region suggests, this court isn't going to make Mr. Ewing a physician. As a matter of fact, no court's been asked to make Mr. Ewing a physician. All he's asked for in this case is the right to take the examination again. He'll live or die by that. In 1981, the regents could have let him take the exam right then and there. We wouldn't have had to go to court to try to vindicate this right. If they thought he was going to fail, let him fail. If they thought he was going to pass, why did they treat him differently? This record also indicates there is a rule.
What does your client want today by way of relief?
The relief he seeks is the right to take this examination at the University of Michigan, which does two things.
Does he want to go back to the University
of Michigan? Well, it gives him the opportunity to go back. He's re-enrolled in medical school. He's now in his second year of medical school. We'll give him the opportunity to go back, and more importantly, we'll give him the opportunity to remove the stigma of his academic dismissal, which is going to follow him throughout his professional life.
Well, is he alleging that he wants to take the exam because he wants to gain admission, readmission to
medical school? Yes, the relief of the order that's actually before this court is an order that orders the regents to permit him to take the examination, and if he passes it, to treat him to pass him on to the third phase, which is what they would have done. The testimony is unequivocal at trial that the only thing that's kept him from going on is he failed this exam. The deans were unanimous that if he had passed the exam, he would have been promoted to the third two-year phase of his
education. But even if he goes back, you can't get rid of the fact that he did flunk more times than anybody else ever flunked.
No. Oh, excuse me, Justice.
You can't get rid of that, can you?
Justice Marshall, many people flunked. 40 people flunked.
You can't get rid of that, can you?
No, we cannot. But the fact of the matter is that the record is clear in Plaintiff's Exhibit 1 that 40 students, including Mr. Ewing, between 1975 and 1982, failed this examination on the first try. 39 were given a second chance. 10 were given a third chance. 1 was given a fourth chance. We're not asking for a third chance. We're not asking for a fourth chance. We're asking for the rule to be followed that Michigan set forth.
But you promise us that if he rules with you and he flunks again, you won't ask for another one.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I promise that to the district court. I promise that to the Court of Appeals. And as an officer of the court, I'll promise that to you.
Mr. Conway, as I read the record, no one ever had as low a score as your client on that exam. Is that correct, Michigan?
The record's a little ambiguous on that. The evidence was that no one in the Interflex program, the district judge elaborated and said no one. But the fact of the matter is, and we put it in our appendix, that in the Court of Appeals, in the brief of the regents, they said the lowness of the score had nothing to do with his dismissal. They've disclaimed that, just as they've disclaimed in answer to Justice White's question, any issue that there isn't a property interest.
May I come back to my question?
Yes.
Did the Court of Appeals conclude that that finding of the district court was clearly erroneous?
No, it didn't address that finding.
Aren't we bound by it?
That he had the lowest score?
That your client had the lowest score of any medical student who'd ever taken this examination.
Well, I think the only fact in the record, Your Honor, is that he had the lowest score in the Interflex program, and you're bound by that. The other, there's no evidence whatsoever on
is
that.
Is there any evidence in the record as to anyone who ever made consistently as low grades as
no,
your
No, because in discovery, we were not given access to any of those things, Your Honor. As you'll see from the record, we were given statistical information with names removed, which is what we asked for. But the significance of that, Your Honor, counsel wants to tell you about Mr. Ewing's various shortcomings. There's two answers to this. Whatever they may be, it isn't for a court to decide if they were important. The people to decide they're important are the professors, and the professor said he was qualified. He had no deficiency. Justice Stevens asked about this letter. Well, the record is clear, and it's in Joint Appendix 81 and 82, that every time he got a warning, it was removed. And one of those warning letters, Plaintiff's Exhibit 9, is in the record. And it says, we congratulate you that your deficiency has been removed. Now, what it turned out at trial was there was a notion of forgiven but not forgotten. But in fact, what was told Mr. Ewing was that he was removed, and the most important thing is the dean said he was qualified.
Is that irrational to say that it's forgiven but not forgotten? I mean, he may come perilously close to flunking out at one point, then he brings himself up, so whatever warning was on then. But if it happens three times, they don't have to act as if it was the first time it happened.
No, Justice Rehnquist, but they didn't have to tell him it was removed either, and they did. And the significance here is Mr. Dane refers to the board minutes. Let's talk about the board minutes. We objected to the board minutes at trial as being prepared in anticipation of litigation and as being hearsay. The district judge permitted those to be received in evidence. We raised that objection in the Sixth Circuit very strenuously about the inadmissibility of these exhibits. The Sixth Circuit didn't pass on it because they ruled in respondents' favor. So I respectfully suggest that they can't rely on evidence to which objection has been made.
Which the district court overruled?
Why should this court for the first time address the evidentiary point?
We're dealing with a record we're made up in the district court, and as I understand it, these were proffered by the defendant, admitted into the evidence by the district court. You challenged the admission in the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit didn't pass on it. Are you saying we can't consider that evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think...
That would be an extraordinary doctrine.
Well, Justice, I think prudentially, I don't know why you would want to get into an issue that the Court of Appeals didn't have the opportunity to pass on. The only reason they didn't pass on it is they found that with those in the record, there was a rule and that it had been violated. And
this is a state institution.
Yes, it is.
And the minutes are prepared pursuant to the state law.
I don't know of any state law, Justice Marshall. There may be one, but I'm not familiar with it. The testimony at trial was that the minutes were prepared and reviewed by counsel.
Do you know of any minutes of a state agency that aren't admissible?
There is the exception under 8038, Mr. Justice Marshall, but there also is the doctrine of prepared in anticipation of litigation, and the testimony at trial was that they were doing
this. Does that apply to a state institution?
I think it would apply to any document prepared in
you
anticipation do. Of litigation, Your
you
Honor.
Think so?
Yes, Your Honor.
I still can't get away from the point that you can't correct his image.
Well, Your Honor,
if we rule and give you everything you want, you can't erase that man's image.
Well, Your Honor, there are many other fine graduates of the university's medical school who failed this examination two times, three times, four times. On the academic record, by the university's own calculation, out of 23 courses, he had difficulties in three of them. There were students who had him in 70% of their courses, 50% of their courses. One student, 9 out of 23, in the same Interflex program.
Mr. Conway, does the record tell us what his grade average was at the time he stood for the examination?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it was approximately a B-minus average. It's 2.7 or 8. At the time he sat for the examination. And he was in good standing. He was in a difficult Interflex program, which takes students
from... May I also ask if, in your view, the record tells us why he was dismissed?
It doesn't, Your Honor. That's why it's arbitrary. Let me return to the Romeo test. I think the Romeo test is very akin to the arbitrary and capricious test. It was advanced by the AAUP here. And the test is very similar because the Romeo test says, was there such a substantial departure from past judgment, practice, or procedures that indicates that the presumed validity of the professional's decision can be overcome. The arbitrary and capricious test is really, in substance, no different than that because it's prima facie correct, and it has to be shown to have no rational basis. And I think the AAUP's suggestion that the Romeo and Younger case serves as a appropriate vehicle, I agree with. It's akin to the arbitrary and capricious test which have been applied by these courts, which was discussed in dictum in Horwitz. The significance of it is here, let's look at the past judgment, practice, and policy. The judgment of the regents was, we'll allow people to test. They published that in their rule. They gave it to everybody.
Well, you say they published it in their rule. Now, are you talking about that brochure?
Well, Your Honor, the Sixth Circuit...
And I wasn't asking you about the Sixth Circuit characters.
Yes.
I asked you if you're talking about what they published in their brochure.
Exhibit 3, Your Honor. And that's the pamphlet on becoming a doctor. And the significance of that, Your Honor, is that they held it out to the community to rely upon. And if you look at their past, and also we have the fact that every other student similarly situated was given a second chance.
Well, of course, the faculty argues that this guy was such a loser that he was not similarly situated.
That's their argument, but that's not their evidence. Your Honor, he's the only student among the 40 to have an honors grade and published research. But I don't think the fact of the matter is that the court needs to delve into that, because what the Sixth Circuit held was, under the university's own rule of a qualified student, he was qualified. The Sixth Circuit didn't create a rule. You know, the notion of substantive due process connotes to some people judges making policy. That's not what we're asking for here. What we're asking for here, and I think that's why the Romeo test is an appropriate analogy.
Well, are you saying that the faculty can't determine whether the student is reasonably qualified or
not? Yes, and they did. They determined he was reasonably qualified and let him take the exam. It's just, Justice O'Connor, as if they said, you're qualified to take this final exam, and you begin taking it, and halfway through they take your paper away. The notion here was you got two chances.
They didn't take it away. He took the exam and flunked it badly, and that entered into the calculation of whether the faculty thought he was qualified.
Well, Your Honor, it didn't, because two things. One, the suggestion that there was some kind of deliberative process is unsupported by the record. While these students routinely came up on the agenda, it was also said that everyone was routinely given a second chance. So there isn't any calculus here of a discretionary judgment. They made their judgment. This exam, I should point out to the court, is constructed so that 10% fail, regardless of your raw score. 10% fail. That's a bell curve. So the university, you know, has suggested, for example, that they've now raised the score. They didn't tell you. They raised it in Plaintiff's Exhibit 5, that now students get three chances, every student. It's a published rule disseminated to their faculty. The NBME itself, which administers this exam, and it's Plaintiff's Exhibit 5, it's 4, and 5 is their rule. 4 says that every student under the NBME's guidelines gets three chances. The fact of the matter here is that Ewing was singled out. And when counsel goes and suggests to you some particular factual matter...
Can you give me an idea why Ewing was singled out?
No, Your Honor, I can't. That's the bottom line notion of an arbitrary decision. They said he was qualified. Dean Reed, with whom he spoke right after he took the exam, and Dean Reed was the dean in charge of this program, told him that, oh, yeah, you'll probably be given a second chance. And that's in the record.
They decided one guy will suck it to.
There's nothing in the record to give it. Yes, Your Honor.
And they didn't pay any attention to the fact that he had the worst record.
He did not have a worst record, Justice Marshall. Many students had 3 and 4 times the number of deficiencies he had, and they were given chances. Many students were given 3 times, some 4. And I think when counsel tries to...
He did have the lowest scores in the Interflex program, did he not?
That was the testimony. But their own...
And the district court make a finding on that?
Yes. But, Your Honor, if I might address that point, it's also...
Well, what is there to address so far as the particular factual question? There may be explanations as to why it may not be relevant.
The point... let me offer an explanation then, Your Honor. The standard students, and the testimony is clear, were measured on the same score. 32 of them failed this examination. We don't know what their scores were.
It isn't irrational for a faculty to treat people in an Interflex program differently from a people not in the Interflex program, is it?
It wouldn't be irrational, except they testified they treated them the same. At this stage in their career, Your Honor, The standard students are going to go into their last 2 years, which is the third and fourth year of medical school. The Interflex are going into the last 2 years, the fifth and sixth. They get combined. They've taken the same basic medical school courses, and the university testified.
Well, it strikes me that a number of reasons pop up during your argument which would, you know, plausibly or facially justify different treatment for your client than the others. You have an explanation that it satisfies you for all of them, but it seems to me when there are that many plausible reasons, you're getting away from something that was arbitrary or capricious. You're getting to just a judgment call why you don't think it should have happened.
Well, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I guess the only point I can make to that is that the Sixth Circuit found that there was a rule, found that it applied to Ewing, and found that it was violated. Those are the findings of the court's judgment that's being reviewed here. In the petition, the regents have not suggested that the Sixth Circuit applied the clearly erroneous standard in some different fashion, haven't cited any error in that regard. So the factual predicate that the legal issue arises on here is the Sixth Circuit's finding that there was a rule, it applied to Ewing, that Ewing was qualified within the meaning of the Regents' own standards, and that he was dismissed despite that, and his dismissal resulted in his deprivation of his property interest to not be arbitrarily dismissed. That's the record.
Mr. Conway, can I yes. clarify one thing in my own mind? The property interest, as I understand it under your presentation, is an interest in not being dismissed from the school arbitrarily.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which, conceptually at least, is different from a property right to retake an exam.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, do you contend there was a property right to retake the exam? A contract right would have to be.
There isn't. The property interest that gives rise to the federal claim, if I could answer this way, Your Honor, is his dismissal. If a rule were violated, but as a result of that violation of the rule, there was no deprivation of property without due process. For example, if Ewing were dismissed because after taking this exam he went to his clinical course where in fact he got an honors, but let's say he had done something that in the judgment of the faculty, his performance was so poor, he should be dismissed for that. Then there would be no violation of his property interest because he couldn't retake the exam because for some other reason he was dismissed. The significance here is the combination of the fact that the violation of the rule resulted in the deprivation of the property interest. He might have a contract claim under state law if it were important enough and not a trivial matter, but he wouldn't have a federal claim because what Michigan has defined as his property interest is his dismissal, not some right to take the exam.
Well, is the property right to dismissal?
Yes. Under the Booker case cited by the Sixth Circuit, the Michigan Supreme Court has held there's a property right not to be arbitrarily dismissed. Let me briefly address the 11th Amendment issues. I think there are three answers to that argument that was first raised in rehearing. The first is that the suit against the regents has always been considered by the regents to be against the regents in their official capacity. That can be shown from the joint appendix, where they argued that the money damage claim was barred under Edelman versus Jordan, but said to the district court, you can enter injunctive relief against us. Now, that's somebody who thinks the suit is against the officials in their official capacity. Secondly, we have filed, Justice O'Connor, a motion to amend under the teachings of Brandon versus Holt, where amendment was permitted even though no motion had been filed. And there's no prejudice shown here. There's no objection been filed by the regents. And under Rule 15B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, it is appropriate to conform the evidence, to conform the pleadings to the evidence. Finally, under the Toll case in this court, the regents waived any claim if they now belatedly assert it because they told the district court that they would be liable for injunctive relief.
Your position, I suppose, had the regents raised such a defense in the district court, perhaps you would have amended that.
Right away. As a matter of fact, it's a tactic that the regents continue, and I refer, Your Honor, to the case of Spielberg versus Regents cited in our brief, a 1985 decision where, according to the reported case, it's Spielberg versus Board of Regents, and it's Judge Fikens again, and it's a 1983 action. It's a full consideration, and the 11th Amendment's not mentioned there. You know, some of the hypotheticals that I propose to the court strike the court as far-fetched, but they're not. In this instance, for example, in Crook versus Baker cited in our brief, these same regents were found to have rescinded a graduate student's degree after the fact. Now, the relief we're seeking is very limited here. The decision of the professional judgment of the academicians is prima facie correct. Unless there's such a substantial departure, as we believe there is in this case, that presumption carries the day. But if there is a substantial departure, whether you look at under the Romeo test proposed by the American Association of University Professors in their amicus brief, if you look at it under the arbitrary and capricious test, which has been discussed by the courts heretofore, the result is the same. There is no rational reason for this decision, and the departure is so great.
Yes, sir. One other question. Assume your client were able to retake the exam other than being sponsored by the University of Michigan, say through his present institution or maybe this national organization would let him take it, and he passed with flying colors, say he got a perfect score. Would you say that Michigan would then be constitutionally obligated to readmit him?
Yes, Your Honor, because the consequence is, in this case, that his dismissal, and the testimony of the deans is clear, his dismissal is what arose strictly from failing the exam. Had he passed the exam, he would have been promoted. And let's remember that if he goes back to Michigan, he's going to be under the tutelage of this faculty for 2 more years. He's not going to be made a physician by any judgment of this court. As a matter of fact, I understand, Your Honor, that he will take an examination similar to the NBME for osteopathic medical schools in his current institution. And I should also say that a recent AMA journal article indicates that less than half of the medical schools require this exam. But we've never asked that the exam be waived or that he be promoted. We're only asking that the university, which promulgated some rules, be bound to apply those rules to the students they promulgated it to so that he can have this opportunity, and he'll live or die by the result. Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Dane?
Very little, Your Honor. Simply,
that's consistent.
Pardon me, Mr. Chief Justice. We seek here the application of the traditional rational basis test to assess the eligibility of Mr. Ewing to continue and to obtain the relief that he wants. Clearly, there were many rational bases for the decision to dismiss Scott Ewing from registration.
May I just clarify that one point? What was the reason for his dismissal from the school?
It was the accumulated effect of his academic record, Justice Stevens. If the phrase appears once in the record, it appears 10 times. The straw that broke the camel's back was the failure on the NBME exam. Mr. Conway has just told you that he was failed solely because he flunked the exam. And it's true that that was the precipitating factor which terminated
but
his
the accumulation registration. Is the accumulation the fact that he didn't have better than a B-minus average plus the failure of the exam on a very low score?
It's the reason that I devoted as much time as I did at the outset of my argument, Justice Stevens, to outlining his record for you, because the decision of the faculty was based upon the multiple deficiencies, the makeup exams, the low scores, the combination of the cumulative effect.
Is that to be inferred from the record as a whole, or is there some document where that reason is set forth in a rather succinct fashion?
I think you'll find the record and the reason set forth in the minutes of the 5 meetings to which I made reference in succinct fashion. I'd like to comment on respondent's point question, why didn't we let him take the test and just be done with it? Give him a second chance, let him flunk it, no lawsuit. I think there are two good answers to that question. The first is that the medical faculty considers it very important that its students display the ability to perform in a timely way and to do the things they are assigned under pressure. Mr. Ewing did not demonstrate that ability. In fact, quite the contrary. He was at the 6-year mark when he had completed the work that most Interflex students complete in 4. But the more significant and important answer to that question is that our medical faculty feels very keenly its obligation to the public to assure the public that the holder of an MD degree from Michigan is a qualified physician. They had reached a careful and considered judgment that Mr. Ewing was not going to be a qualified physician, and they felt a duty to dismiss him from registration without permitting him to go forward in the program. I think I'll conclude with that, if the Court please.
May I ask this question just to clarify my understanding of the case? The district court's first opinion back in 1982 concluded by holding that the university was entitled to 11th Amendment immunity and that there had been no waiver of that immunity. Then the subsequent opinion of the district court addressed the substantive issue in the case without deciding it on 11th Amendment immunity. What is the explanation of that?
Justice Powell, the motion was for dismissal of count 3 of the complaint which sought monetary damages. And the explanation is that the decision by Judge Fikens was filed before this court's decision in Pennhurst. Pennhurst changed our perception and the court's perception, I think, of the scope of the 11th Amendment defense as it applied to claims for injunctive relief against the state. It has been clear for some time that claims for monetary relief were clearly barred, but claims for prospective injunctive relief have been in a much less clear area, if I may say. Pennhurst changed that with respect to claims for injunctive relief against states to compel them to conform their conduct to state law. And at the bottom of this case, it is our contention that that's what plaintiff seeks, is an injunction compelling the University of Michigan to conform its conduct to its rule. As a constitutional corporation of the state of Michigan, rules created by the university may be regarded as state laws, I think, within the same scope as the state laws which were at issue in Pennhurst. Therefore, if the case is seen as an effort by respondent to compel the university to conform its conduct to this so-called rule, then I suggest that it fits within the rubric of Pennhurst and should be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...